border in a humane way or continues breaking its promises to welcome migrants into the country.
Nerves are growing more frayed in the EU ahead of winter time. Gas prices have soared by 250% since the start of the year, and supplies are depleting. Almost half of all gas used in the EU is imported from Russia, but relations between the bloc and Moscow are at an all-time low. Analysts say it's not surprising, therefore, that the Kremlin is reluctant to increase supplies. The crisis has been discussed at a meeting of EU energy ministers attended by senior European Commission officials.
We have to end our dependence on foreign volatile fossil fuels as soon as possible. We also need to take energy efficiency seriously.
Experts say ordinary hard-pressed citizens are now paying the price because the EU refuses to dial down its anti-Russia rhetoric.
It's not possible to expect that European Union will export its rules, its behavior, all its values to everybody in this neighborhood. But it seems to me that the feeling here sometimes in the political bodies of the European Union is the following. If others are not taking the internal rules of the European Union, that does mean that they are wrong, that they are incorrect.
Gas prices have shot up due to demand because economies are bouncing back from the pandemic. In the EU, last winter and spring were colder than usual, and so gas reserves in the 27-nation bloc were hit. Since then, power grids have not benefited much from wind energy due to mild weather conditions. Moscow and Berlin want the speedy approval of Nord Stream 2, the controversial pipeline under the Baltic Sea that will double Russian gas exports to Germany. Completed earlier this month, the pipeline cannot start delivering gas until it clears regulatory hurdles here in the European Commission. The United States is very much against the Russian-German gas pipeline, and analysts say Washington is putting the EU under pressure to try and delay things. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Muslims marked Arbaeen, the 40th day that followed the anniversary of the martyrdom of Imam Hussein, peace be upon him, the third Shia Imam and his 72 strong companions in the Battle of Karbala in what is now southern Iraq in 680 AD. Each year, millions of Muslim mourners set out on a symbolic 80-kilometer-long walk that begins from the holy city of Najaf in Iraq, where Imam Hussein's father Imam Ali's shrine is located, to the holy city of Karbala that houses Imam Hussein's shrine. But this year, due to COVID-19 pandemic, Iraq has imposed restrictions on the number of pilgrims. According to Iranian officials, nearly 60,000 Iranian pilgrims have traveled to Iraq to partake in the huge annual Arbaeen procession. The Arbaeen march is of great significance for Muslims. In Iran, those who cannot make it to Karbala take part in a symbolic march from Tehran to the town of Ray towards the holy shrine of Hazrat Abdulazim Hassani.
Arbaeen march is one of the largest religious gatherings in the world, which manifests the extent of the age-old love for Imam Hussein and his ideology of resistance against injustice. This year, although the COVID-19 pandemic has either cancelled or restricted most of the mourning processions, our love for Imam Hussein runs deep in our hearts and will never fade away.
The love for Imam Hussein runs in our family. My family and I always take part in such religious ceremonies to remember Imam Hussein, because with his sacrifice, he saved the true Islam. Still after 14 centuries, we honor him as a savior of our religion, and he's the best role model for me and my children.
Over the past decade, the Iranian and Iraqi people have begun participating in what came to be known as the Great Walk of Arbaeen, a procession during which millions of Iranian and Iraqi Shias travel on foot to the shrine city of Karbala, south of Iraq, to renew allegiance with the ideals and teachings of Imam Hussein, peace be upon him. The Battle of Karbala featured an unjust fight between Imam Hussein and his army and the hugely outnumbered army of the Umayyad Caliph of the time, Yazid.
The Day of Arbaeen is a day on which the family members of Imam Hussein return to the plain of Karbala to properly bid farewell to their fallen heroes and finally grieve for their loved ones. Saman Kujuri, Tehran.
Thank you. the limelight.
Corporate journalists overwhelmingly leaned on government and military sources, while offering no clear anti-war voices and vanishingly few perspectives from civil society leaders in either Afghanistan or the United States, says Julie Hollar, writer, in an article titled Missing Voices in Broadcast Coverage of Afghan Withdrawal. Stay tuned for more. As the U.S., after 20 years, finally began its withdrawal from Afghanistan, the story dominated TV news. Just as they did when the war began, corporate journalists overwhelmingly leaned on government and military sources while offering no clear anti-war voices and vanishingly few perspectives from civil society leaders in either Afghanistan or the United States. Fair studied a week of Afghanistan coverage, starting with the day the Taliban took back Kabul. Fair looked at the three prime-time broadcast news shows, ABC World News Tonight, CBS Evening News, and NBC Nightly News, identifying 74 sources across the three shows. Of these sources, 23 sources were Afghans, 20 were identified as Afghan-Americans, and 31% of all sources. Only 11 of these 23, fewer than half, were identified by at least a first name, and only 4 were women. Afghans often have only one name. While 3 Afghan sources were identified as professionals who might have offered informed commentary on the broader political or historical situation, a journalist, a member of parliament, and a nonprofit director, the vast majority of questions to all Afghan and Afghan-American sources were about their personal risk and situation, essentially providing color rather than expert opinion to the story. Americans who were not Afghans comprised the remaining 51 sources, with no other nationalities represented. Of these U.S. sources, 31 were non-Pentagon government officials, and 16 were current or former military, from the Secretary of Defense to enlisted troops. The remainder were 3 parents of Americans killed in the war, and the non-Afghan U.S. citizens evacuating from Afghanistan. The partisan breakdown of U.S. officials was 29 Democrats to 8 Republicans. With President Joe Biden accounting for 14 of the Democratic sources and other members of his administration accounting for 12. No scholars or anti-war activists from either the U.S. or Afghanistan were featured. Only 2 civil society leaders made appearances: the director of a nonprofit women's organization in Afghanistan and the president of a New York City veterans organization. Despite the media's emphasis on the plight of women in Afghanistan as a result of U.S. withdrawal, women were rarely considered experts or even voices worth hearing on this story. Only 8 sources were female, 11% of the total, 2 of whom were unnamed. And corporate journalists themselves, who have often been the loudest cheerleaders for Afghanistan war, continued their jingoism in the face of the withdrawal. NBC's chief foreign correspondent Richard Engel, for instance, offered an echo of rather than a counterpoint to McConnell and Abdul. A 20-year war, the longest in U.S. history today, ended a disgrace. The U.S. leaving behind a country its citizens are too terrified to live in. Similarly, CBS Nora O'Donnell declared, "When America leaves, for many, so does the hope of freedom, the hope for human rights, and in place comes the sheer terror of what's next." O'Donnell went on to detail the number of Americans killed and wounded, plus the unspecified cost to America's national security. Given that the withdrawal was an acknowledgement that after 20 years of occupation, the U.S. had little control over what kind of country
it would be leaving behind is hardly to imagine a withdrawal that Engel would not have considered a disgrace. But while he and O'Donnell highlighted the plight of many Afghans, neither made any mention of the number of Afghans killed or wounded in the 20-year war, which was at least 27 times higher than U.S. casualties, according to the Cost of War Project at Brown University. That project estimated that at least 46,000 Afghan civilians were killed, including more than 500 humanitarian workers and journalists, along with over 69,000 national military and police, and more than 52,000 opposition fighters. But these tallies, which do not even include the wounded or excess, I mean, and direct death, are almost certainly undercounts. New Yorker reporter Anand Gopal, who has spent years covering the war, including time in rural Afghanistan, believes that the available death tolls have grossly undercounted civilian casualties, as much of the ongoing conflict has taken place in outlying areas where deaths frequently go unrecorded. Gopal's recent article, New Yorker, on rural Afghan women recounted his investigation in the largely rural Helmand province, where he interviewed a random selection of 12 households, finding that each had lost, on average, 10 to 12 civilians to the war. While the Taliban rule was not popular among those he interviewed, it was clearly preferred to U.S. occupation, which had empowered even more ruthless warlords and ensured unending conflict, airstrikes, and terror in the region. This perspective was not to be found on U.S. TV news coverage of the withdrawal, with its correspondents reporting from the airbase in Kabul and Afghanistan, a world apart from that known by the majority of the country's population. NBC's Lester Holt, who visited Afghanistan in 2010 and 2012, offered a typical assessment, painting the occupation as a sensitive operation bringing Afghanistan out of darkness into a brighter future, saying, "Traveling across Afghanistan a decade into the war in 2012, it was hard not to feel some optimism as if we were witness to a country emerging from darkness. Through the war, epic American-led battles reclaimed cities and villages from the Taliban. U.S. commanders nurtured trust among village elders believing in Afghanistan's future. And now, in the chaos, we are left to wonder how that future has been so rapidly rewritten with the chapters from Afghanistan's past." 2 weeks later, on the eve of the official withdrawal, CBS O'Donnell asked longtime Pentagon correspondent David Martin, "What does this moment mean?" Martin responded, "To me, it's on all of us as American citizens. We as a country could not summon the will to outlast the Taliban. We sent more than 800,000 troops to fight in the war. The vast majority of them did everything we asked of them. They would have gone back for another 20 years if we had asked them. But the country grew tired of the war, and they elected political leaders, both Democratic and Republican, who wanted to end it. History will decide whether that was right or wrong. But either way, Nora, it's on us," unquote. Perspectives of U.S. troops were occasionally presented, but segments featuring veterans' voices seemed largely intended to reassure viewers that the 20-year war was worth it. Some veterans are thinking, was it worth it? Were U.S. sacrifices worth it? O'Donnell said, followed immediately by a soundbite from a veteran. "It was worth it. We gave Afghanistan 2 decades of freedom. It made the world a better place," unquote. notably post 9/11 veterans, had soured on the war over the past decade. While a 2011 Pew poll found that 50% believed the Afghanistan war had been worth fighting, the outfit's 2019 poll found that the number had dropped to 38%, roughly on par with the general public. Afghanistan veterans were more likely than the general public to support the withdrawal, 58% versus 52%, even after it was well underway and the subject of widespread one-sidedly hostile media coverage in Morning Consult.
Fiqh or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked in
the Holy Prophet of Islam is the example
of
self-purification is the most significant
factor.
Imamate is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism. This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. Welcome to another episode of Ulama's Speech. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short speech by famous Iranian Shiite orator and lecturer Hujjatul Islam Ali. Stay tuned. May Allah bless the soul of the late Ayatollah Mujtahidi Tehrani. Once he asked his master and teacher, the late Grand Ayatollah Sayyid Ahmad Khansari, about the true conducts for visiting the tombs of the infallibles and how to formulate our wordings in our prayers before the shrines. He asks Ayatollah Khansari, in visiting the tomb of the great men of Allah and supplicating towards them, which method is better? To ask Allah and attest him through naming an infallible, or ask Allah directly to answer our prayers?
آیت‌الله استعمال آقای خانساری که مرجع فوق‌العاده‌ای بود. شوف فرمود هر دوش خوبه.
The late Sayyid Khansari's answer was that both of his manners are great. Whether you ask an infallible saint of Allah to ask Allah to answer prayers, or you yourself ask Allah directly to do so. However, If you, in the shrine of a masoom or the descendant of a masoom, ask him or her to be the link between you and Allah, it would be better. Even you can go to the tombs of the great men of Allah who were not infallible and ask their soul to be the bridge between you and Allah. This statement of the late Grand Ayatollah Mujtahidi Tehrani as quoting his master and teacher, the late Grand Ayatollah Sayyid Ahmad Khansari, shows that even the great men of Allah, lower rank than the infallibles, can help us achieve the answer to our prayers, and we must not be inattentive towards them or visiting their shrines. In other words, these individuals are more compatible to us in terms of spirituality, so our souls can be connected more easily through prayers and supplications. Thank you very much, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, for listening to this episode of Ulama's Speech, which was the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Ali. To find out more about this program, log on to our website, parstoday.com, Call of Islam page. We leave you in Allah's care. Fi amanillah.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
The wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
Retired Army Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson is the former Chief of Staff to U.S. Secretary of State Colin Powell, who emerged as a leading critic of the New Conservatives. New Conservatives are characterized by their support of hawkish foreign policies. In remarks to Mass Peace Action last June, he made some brazen assertions about Israel.
I said the other day Israel would not be a state in 20 years. It'd be gone. It certainly will not be a democracy. It'll be an apartheid state. And the world will just reject it, as they did South Africa. But I'm now saying it probably won't be a state. It'll be gone.
He pointed to the 1946 Joint Chiefs of Staff to State War Navy Coordinating Committee, noting that then U.S. President Harry Truman was trying at the time to decide whether to recognize Israel in 1947-48 and what to do about U.S. policy. Wilkerson said, Israel is a strategic liability of the first order for the United States, and the chances are very high it would drag Washington's feet into a full-fledged face-off.
Israel is the most likely state in the world to take the United States to Armageddon. And I could paint you all sorts of ways we would do that and the ways we would get there.
The retired general also revealed that during 40 years of military service, He had heard constant advice from everyone not to establish an American military base in the Israeli-occupied territories. He stressed that the United States standing with Israel against half of the world is not a good thing. The Israeli regime, he said, needs to be reined, but that would not happen.
Israel, I think, needs to be reined in, and it needs to be told in no uncertain terms, you will change, and you will change swiftly and effectively, or you can count your sugar daddy gone. Yeah, not going to happen. Not going to happen.
In fact, Washington has played a key role in shielding Israel for decades through the supply of arms, financial support, and UN vetoes.
Well, I certainly think that that's a possibility. I do agree that it is delegitimizing itself, even in the eyes of many Jews around the world, especially young Jews, which is going to make it hard, of course, for Israel to reproduce itself. And yes, I think it's being considered more and more a worldwide pariah.
Wilkerson has said that the obsession of U.S. neoconservatives, particularly former Vice President Dick Cheney and former Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld, is to plunge the entire Middle East region into chaos and to keep Israel's enemies at each other's throats so that they could not unite and give Israel trouble, militarily or otherwise. Wilkerson also pointed out that it does not matter for neoconservatives to target Lebanon, Syria, Iraq, or Iran in their pursuit to set the region on fire, as the important thing for them is to protect Israel. However, the axis of resistance in the region has so far managed to oppose Western, namely United States and Israel, interests in the region and foiled their plots. Members of the axis of resistance include Iran, Syria, and Lebanon's Hezbollah, and the Palestinian Islamic Jihad and Hamas, to name a few. The latest sign of this assertion is the U.S. House of Representatives' decision to pass a bill to provide $1 billion of additional funding to replenish Israel's so-called Iron Dome anti-missile system, despite the regime's blatant violation of Palestinian human rights.
In recent decades, the United States has increasingly used sanctions as an instrument of foreign policy. There are different types of sanctions, economic or financial restrictions, trade prohibitions, and blocking or seizing assets of individuals, organizations, and countries. Now, a coalition of North American human rights organizations, named the Sanctions Kill Coalition, has released a report on the impacts of the U.S. sanctions on other countries and their people. Whether direct or indirect, most of the U.S. sanctions are not authorized by the United Nations Security Council, and many of them are imposed unilaterally by Washington. In fact, more than two-thirds of the world's countries officially condemn U.S. sanctions as a blatant violation of international law and the UN Charter. The report has also revealed a bitter reality that Western media rarely or never talk about. One finding is that U.S. sanctions are hurting the most vulnerable and driving middle-class citizens into poverty. Also, they have resulted in thousands of deaths and humanitarian exemptions. For instance, U.S. sanctions on the Syrian Central Bank have collapsed the country's currency, sending millions of civilians into grinding poverty. Also, waiving sanctions by the U.S. undermine countries' capacity to respond to the coronavirus pandemic, resulting in loss of lives. The inhumane sanctions cause difficulty for countries like Iran to obtain medical supplies, sanitation equipment, and other necessary goods to slow the virus spread. Therefore, the U.S. contributed to many unnecessary deaths in Iran.
So we've actually known for 100 years, at least a century, what the impact is. The impact is primarily felt by the civilian population, and it is devastating.
The report also says many U.S. sanctions are based on false claims of an emergency and a threat to national security. The 76th annual session of the United Nations General Assembly kicked off in New York. World leaders discussed a myriad of topics of global concern, including rejecting inhumane sanctions. During his speech at the United Nations General Assembly, Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro called for the lifting of sanctions imposed by the United States and the European Union on his country.
Las reservas internacionales legales.
We ratify our request.
Our demand to the United States and the European Union governments lift all the criminal sanctions against the Venezuelan economy, against the Venezuelan society. We say it with the reason and morality that we have, and we say it on behalf of 30 million Venezuelans.
Maduro denounced what he called permanent systematic aggression waged against Venezuela through these restrictions and called for the establishment of a new world free of colonialism and imperialism. Also, Cuban President Díaz-Canel lashed out at the U.S. administration of Joe Biden for intensifying, quote, the cruelest economic blockade ever imposed against any nation.
The U.S. government has not for 1 minute ceased its attacks on Cuba. But at this crucial and challenging moment for all nations, its aggressiveness exceeds all limits. The cruelest and most prolonged economic, commercial, and financial blockade ever applied against any nation has been opportunistically and criminally intensified in the midst of the pandemic.
Addressing the UN General Assembly, the Cuban president said, "The U.S. is extorting sovereign states to act against countries it identifies as adversaries." He said the U.S. presses its allies to build coalitions to overthrow legitimate governments. Western media has failed, or maybe wanted to fail, to inform the public about the consequences and global condemnation of U.S. sanctions. Most U.S. citizens are unaware of the severe harm being done to millions of residents of countries such as Venezuela, Cuba, Syria, and Iran.
It's a primary foreign policy tool that the U.S. government uses in order to weaken and decimate countries that it has disputes with. It should be considered a crime against humanity. The kind of sanctions against a country, against a whole people or a whole nation, should be considered a crime against humanity because the effects are horrible.
Exacerbating the suffering of civilians in different countries during a severe health crisis such as the coronavirus pandemic is morally corrupt and a clear disregard for basic human rights. This is what U.S. sanctions have done. The U.S. may be quick to deny this, but deep down it wants sanctions to provoke the populations to rise against the government in the hopes of regime change in the respective countries, something it has for the most part failed to achieve.
After days of controversy, the U.S. House of Representatives has passed a $1 billion bill to fund Israel's so-called Iron Dome missile system. American lawmakers approved the bill in a 420-9 vote on Thursday. The push had appeared in a bill on Tuesday aimed at providing emergency funding to the U.S. government to avoid a shutdown, but was later removed without explanation. The removal was attributed to opposition from a small group of Democrats who demand the U.S. support for Israel be based on the regime's human rights record. The exclusion of the provision, however, drew strong reactions from Republicans and pro-Israeli Democrats, with Republican Senator Lindsey Graham calling the move despicable.
The progressive movement in Congress consists of maybe, less than 10% of the Congress. So they have very little power, and furthermore, the progressives in Congress don't often use their power. They're intimidated a lot of times into going along with the rest of it. So we can't expect very much from the progressives.
Israeli Prime Minister Naftali Bennett thanked both parties in the House for their support, adding that those who tried to challenge the U.S. support for Israel got a resounding response. The bill is now heading to the Senate, where it's highly likely to be approved, as American politicians from both political camps have traditionally backed Israel. It's also expected to be signed into law by President Joe Biden, who has already signaled support for the additional aid. Pro-Israel American lawmakers have been pushing for additional funds to Israel to replenish the regime's missile system since the most recent war on Gaza ended in a ceasefire earlier this year. The truce stopped the 11-day conflict in May, the most intense fighting between Palestinian resistance groups and Israel in years. Palestinians have hailed their victory in the battle, citing the show of force to the Israeli regime by launching over 4,000 rockets and scores of drones to combat the enemy. The sheer scale of the attacks overwhelmed Israel's so-called Iron Dome anti-missile system. The war killed over 250 Palestinians, including 66 children in Gaza and 12 people in Israel. That's a significant number, considering the regime's heavy expenditure on anti-missile systems, while the resistance in the impoverished and besieged Gaza Strip has no means of shooting down Israel's missiles.
From the point of view of justice, there's no reason not for Palestinians not to have an Iron Dome system. But obviously, that's not what Israel wants at all. Israel wants to be able to hit Palestinians, to cause misery and destruction and death to Palestinians whenever they feel like it.
The move by Washington to increase aid to Israel comes despite calls by some U.S. politicians and activists to cut fundings to pressure the regime into respecting Palestinians' rights. With all that said, the reversal of the move to include the additional aid to Israel in the U.S. government's spending budget suggests that Washington's unwavering support for the regime is beginning to falter, as no U.S. lawmaker would hesitate to approve more funding for Israel a few years ago.
Thousands of Yemenis have taken to the streets to mark the 7th anniversary of the September 21 revolution against the Saudi-backed regime in Sana'a. Participants in the rally chanted slogans against foreign aggression while carrying the country's tricolor flag and pictures of top resistance leaders. They also denounced the criminal complicity of Western powers and the Israeli regime in the Saudi-backed aggression in war-ravaged Yemen. The demonstrators vowed to uphold their revolutionary ideals and not surrender to the foreign powers. They said the popular revolution had thwarted the conspiracy to divide Yemen through resistance to foreign aggression and hegemony.
Yemeni people are working hard to liberate themselves from the tutelage and occupation. It is known to the world that the occupation does not last, and no matter how long it remains, it will eventually depart.
In 2014, the people of Yemen led a popular uprising against the Saudi-backed, unpopular regime of Abdurrahman Mansur Hadi. As protests gripped the country, the Ansarullah resistance movement on September 21 took control of the capital Sana'a, following a rapid advance south from their northern stronghold of Sada'a. The massively popular protests were against the incompetent and corrupt regime in Sana'a, backed by Riyadh and directed by the U.S. In a bid to crush the resistance and reinstall the Hadi regime, the Saudi-led coalition launched a ferocious bombing campaign on the neighboring Arab country barely 6 months later.
I think at this present time, the Saudis are willing to keep this thing going. Even if they can't win, they'll keep it going so as to not be pointed at and said they lost. How long they can do this is, I don't know, but I think that's our present situation.
The leader of Yemen's Ansarullah resistance movement says the U.S. was in charge of administering his country's internal affairs prior to the popular revolution against former Yemeni President Abdurrahman Mansur Hadi, better known as the September 21 revolution. He highlighted that Washington used to conduct Yemen's affairs before the September 21 revolution, and the U.S. embassy in Sana'a had the upper hand over the presidential office. The Ansarullah leader went on to say that the U.S. used al-Qaeda terrorists to create division within Yemen and to advance its hegemonic agenda, stressing that Washington also sought to influence Yemen's educational system in favor of the Israeli regime.
The Saudis and the UAE are influenced by the U.S., as is the U.S. influenced by them. They are dependent often on U.S. weapons, of which they are major purchasers, and that makes us dependent on them. But they are not controlled by Washington.
He added that Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates are just pawns in the hands of the U.S. and are cows being milked by Washington to serve the Tel Aviv regime's interests. Saudi Arabia, backed by the U.S. and regional allies, launched the war in Yemen in March 2015 with the goal of bringing Hadi's government back to power and crushing Ansarullah.
I don't think that the Saudis can win under present circumstances. And I think the support, whatever they got out of Trump, is probably less now, relatively speaking, under Biden. But there's this other factor, and the factor is that the Saudi government and the head of the Saudi government doesn't want to lose face. Now, you and I might be able to accept losing face under certain circumstances, but they don't believe that they ever want to lose face.
The war has left hundreds of thousands of Yemenis dead and displaced millions more. It has also destroyed Yemen's infrastructure and spread famine and infectious diseases. The Yemeni armed forces and allied popular committees, however, have grown steadily in strength against the Saudi-led invaders, leaving Riyadh and its allies bogged down in the country.
The Light.
Technology plays an important role in our daily lives. This time, a French company has introduced a device to help the visually impaired to avoid obstacles. The smart electronic device detects obstacles and warns users with a beep. People with vision loss can install it on the top of their canes and receive information through headphones. The gadget helps people to dodge barriers on the ground and above that, for example, the open door of a truck.
If you hear the sound to the right, it means that the obstacle is on the right. If it is straight ahead, the obstacles are in front of you. So you change course according to what you hear. If you hear an obstacle to the left, you go to the right, and this way you can go around the obstacle.
The device costs around $2,300 and is now being used by hundreds of people in Belgium, France, Germany, Italy, and Switzerland. Most of us know the feeling of being moved by a work of art. Well, a Kosovar artist tries to make us understand a form of political discourse through a mosaic of outgoing German Chancellor Angela Merkel. Alkan Bozagur has made a Merkel mosaic from seeds. The artist says he wished to thank the German leader for having been an example for all the women of the world. He says his work is also a tribute to the towering lady for the support she had given to his country, which declared its independence in 2008. Bozagur was doing his work on the same day Germans were voting in the general elections to choose a successor to Merkel. Alkan Bozagur holds two Guinness World Records for his giant mosaics made with seeds.
Wally the Walrus has risen to fame with his extensive travels around Europe. Now the giant mammal has added Iceland to his list of trips. Wally has previously visited France, Spain and the UK. His last known location before Iceland was Ireland. Scientists were not sure at first if they had indeed seen Wally, but Seal Rescue Ireland recognized him from scars on his front flippers. The wandering walrus is 4 years old and weighs about a ton. He has covered a distance of around 5,000 kilometers in his recent trips. Wally is now on his way towards his home in the Arctic. The French zoo has had a very productive year, welcoming multiple new animals into its collection. Two pumas, two jaguars, nine Peruvian squirrel monkeys, and even rarer macaque twins are new additions to the Mingmi Zoo this summer. The animals were bred as part of a program designed to maintain and promote the conservation of endangered species. Once they reach the breeding age, these animals will be transported to other zoos to help boost the population of their species.
Now, a museum museum in Russia's Kaliningrad has unveiled a special exhibition to the public. It would not be exactly wrong to call the artworks out of trash. All the works exhibited are made of rubbish. The exhibition is showcasing a wide array of objects, including sculptures, musical instruments, robots, and costumes. The project was designed with the aim of raising awareness about recycling. People visiting the exhibition were delighted by the creative use of garbage. Only 7% of waste is recycled in Russia each year, while a vast amount of trash is stored in landfills.
An Egyptian artist is making incredibly tiny statues of famous historical figures and landmarks on pencil tips. 30-year-old Ibrahim Balal is based in the city of Rashid, south of Cairo. He has mastered the art of crafting miniature sculptures. Ibrahim mostly creates statues of Egyptian pharaohs, but Islamic, Greek, and Roman figures also feature in his portfolio. The artist received some criticism when he first ventured on his art, but he persevered and rose to prominence with his minuscule statues. Ibrahim's dream is to open a museum of miniature sculptures someday.
Fourteen lucky penguins have been returned to the seas off the Atlantic coast of Argentina after rehabilitating them from malnutrition and hypothermia. The Magellanic penguins waddled back happily into the chilly waters once they were released. They were distressed, malnourished, and dehydrated when they were found by conservationists in February. There are an estimated 2 to 3 million Magellanic penguins in the world. The cute birds are named after Portuguese explorer Ferdinand Magellan. They are mostly found around Argentina and Chile.
Another groundbreaking archaeological discovery in Peru is now catching attention. 800-year-old human remains south of the capital, Lima, highlight the ancient burial rituals in the South American country. The remains of 8 adults and children buried in a common tomb were found by a group of workers laying gas pipes at the site. They were buried with food, dishes, and musical instruments, including flutes. Archaeologists say that the 8 people lived in the ancient town of Chitka, some 60 kilometers from Lima. They say some of the bodies were buried with the shells on their heads and had bags with cocoa leaves inside them. They say the discovery will shed more light on the pre-Hispanic history of the region. Another 30 human remains have been discovered in Chilca in 2018.
A taxi company in Thailand has turned its vehicles into mini vegetable gardens to help its drivers who are out of work due to the coronavirus pandemic.
The point of this project is so that employees have something to do to reduce stress. To a certain extent, it has helped with reducing our stress, but it isn't really the answer to the situation right now. Even though the drivers and the staff are able to harvest the vegetables for food, it's just part of solving the problem. I think the government should also step in to help us too.
The taxi company is growing vegetables on the roofs and hoods of 300 disused taxis that are parked idly. Prolonged COVID-19 lockdowns have affected the drivers' income negatively so that they are unable to pay the lease of their vehicles. Therefore, working in these gardens has reduced their stress and provided the drivers and their families with food.
The Light is a bulletin in which we bring you a lot of interesting news in different fields like animals' life, cultural events, funny trending news, and more from every corner of the world.
Amongst the thousands of shops in Tehran's Grand Bazaar lies a tiny tea house with a long history that attracts visitors with its famous treats. Haj Ali Darvish Tea House is the smallest and oldest tea house in the Iranian capital. The 2-meter-wide cafe belongs to 63-year-old Kazem Maputian, who took over the century-old business from his father. He serves a wide range of teas, but his signature is the tea of kindness, a mixture of mint, lemon, and saffron. His tea house is the most famous in Tehran, serving some 200 customers every day. It used to be a tourist attraction before the coronavirus pandemic. Haj Ali Darvish Tea House was enlisted as Iran's intangible cultural heritage in 2016. Farmers working on the border between Venezuela and Colombia have discovered a tusk that is believed to belong to an American mastodon from 16,000 years ago.
We went to the place and the fossil was there, and then we realized it was something very important. We rescued it because there was a risk of it being lost, and at this moment, it's in the Archaeological and Paleontological Museum of Agualinda.
The experts say the discovery would help them with complementing information about extinct animals and ancient settlements. They say the finding of the tusk in the site would increase its potential contribution to scientific researchers. The discovery of mega faunal fossils in South America has been common over the past decades. In 2019, more than 800 mammoth bones were discovered near Mexico. A group of Cambodian students has designed a manned drone in an attempt to beat traffic. The drone has 8 propellers and a school chair for the pilot's seat. It can carry a human weighing up to 60 kilograms. The creative students say the drone is still in its early stages of development and testing. Equipped with 4 batteries, the human carrier drone can fly up to 4 meters and around 10 minutes above the ground.
Here we have big problems related to traffic jams, so we did some research about this before building the drone. We came up with this drone project as we had the idea that we wanted to solve some problems for our society by making a drone taxi, as well as investing drones for firefighters to help put out fires.
The prototype can or has cost around $20,000 to build. The designers say they need 2 more years to complete the project. The school has expressed hope that the drone could be used in everyday life.
Iran's capital Tehran has hosted an art show themed with Aspiration for Peace. Organized by the Economic Cooperation Organization, the event seeks to shed light on the beauty of a global peace through the language of art. Yusuf Jalali reports.
Each one of these delicate works of art are created by an artist from a different country, each trying a unique way to highlight the need for lasting peace in the world. Dubbed Aspiration for Peace, the art gallery is organized by Echo Cultural Institute with the aim of promoting global peace through the language of art.
By holding this event, we want to send a message of peace to all countries. We invited diplomats from all embassies here to gather and unite and celebrate a peaceful gathering. Also, the artworks showcased here are created by artists from various countries, and this represents how beautiful it is for nations to live peacefully.
Art helps connect different civilizations and nations. It helps us bridge the cultural gaps and find commonalities. This will establish mutual understanding and harmony among nations, and therefore conflicts can be avoided.
In some of the artworks, images immediately communicate with the audience, even if faces are veiled. These pictures try to narrate the story of Afghan women and an uncertain future that they're facing amid the Taliban's takeover of power in Afghanistan.
It
The events that are taking place in my country, Afghanistan, are so painful. It might take hours to tell you how hard it is for an Afghan girl to live in insecurity and uncertainty. But through the language of art, you can understand all these words without the need for translation.
The art show was held on the occasion of the International Day of Peace, observed every year on September 21st. The occasion was introduced by the UN General Assembly as a chance to strengthen the ideals of peace through observing 24 hours of nonviolence and ceasefire.
A picture is worth a thousand words, and indeed, no words can be as strong as the strokes of an artist in speaking the beauty of peace. And this is how the universal language of art transcends the political and cultural boundaries and touches the hearts of viewers, no matter what language they speak. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
French slackliner has wowed watching crowds in Paris by crossing from the Eiffel Tower to the other side of the River Seine. Nathan Poulain walked across a rope suspended 17 meters above the ground. He finished the 600-meter course in half an hour. On one point, he sat and lay on the rope before arriving at his destination, the Chaillot Theater. The 27-year-old daredevil practiced 4 years to perform this show. Poulain said that he was staying focused during the walk, and that was very challenging.
When I was young, I had fear of heights, and I learned to contain it. During the performance, I really didn't feel it. I really didn't have that problem. I felt some stress over starting it, but no vertigo, no.
Poulain said that it was an uneasy experience, but he was happy to share it with the public. The athlete started slacklining 10 years ago. In 2019, he performed a 510-meter-long walk between two skyscrapers in Paris.
Visitors and keepers at a zoo in the Peruvian capital, Lima, are thrilled over the birth of 8 baby penguins from the vulnerable Humboldt species. Zookeepers say the chicks were hatched in July and they're expecting 6 more additions later in October. Currently, the newborns spend their days resting in their nests and being fed by their parents. The Huachipa Zoo currently has 42 Humboldt penguins and is working on recovering the species population.
We have 8 2-month-old chicks and 6 eggs. In 42 days, those eggs will hatch and the chicks will come out. The important thing about Humboldt penguins is that we are recovering their population because they are in a vulnerable state. We are increasing their populations with the breeding we are doing in the zoo.
Researchers say a maximum of less than 10,000 Humboldt penguins are left in the wild, with their population size undergoing extreme fluctuations. The species face emerging threats from agricultural activities to their own vulnerability to predators. The Humboldt penguins are only found along the Pacific coast of Chile and Peru and are enlisted as threatened species by the International Union for Conservation of Nature.
IRIB English Radio.